This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Join me now for the third segment in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993.
The events in the last year of Celia's life, although extraordinarily dramatic, demonstrate the nature of the moral choices individuals faced and indicate that some individuals had great difficulty making them. Those events also suggest that the psychic cost to whites of the defense of slavery, though paid, was high, just as they suggest that the psychic cost to blacks, though paid, was incalculable and endearing.
Melton McLaurin teaches at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. His new book is Celia, a Slave, a story of racial injustice in antebellum Missouri. In just a moment, I'll talk with Melton McLaurin about his book. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Historian Melton McLaurin is the author of Celia, a Slave. The book is a tale of crime and punishment at the time when civil war was imminent in 19th century America. In 1850, a young black woman named Celia was purchased by a wealthy white Missourian named Robert Newsom. In his book about Celia, a Slave, Melton McLaurin narrates the last days and the deaths of both Celia and the man who owned her. McLaurin does so with an eye to the moral dilemmas inherent in the practice of slavery. His book also examines the legal atmosphere that nurtured a double standard in the treatment of black and white women. I asked Melton McLaurin to explain.
Well, Celia was bought really as a concubine in the Old Testament sense. She was bought by a man approximately 55 years old at the time, perhaps a little older, who had recently lost his wife about a year prior to his purchase of Celia, was bought ostensibly to be a cook. But he raped Celia on the day of her purchase, and from that day forward, she was really his concubine, as opposed to saying his mistress. And she was brought home to his large farm. It was not a plantation, a large farm, where he had five other male slaves, and two grown daughters lived with him, and one of those daughters had a family, and Celia was a cook for this family as well as his mistress.
All right, now we place this story, Melton McLaurin, in Callaway County, Missouri, and Celia's fate played itself out in the household of Robert Newsom, a period of what, 4 or 5 years?
Approximately 5 years.
What happened there at the end?
Well, at the end, what happened was she had fallen in love with one of the male slaves, whose name was George, and had been involved in a relationship with him. It appears to be that that was done surreptitiously. George could not stand, his ego could not stand the relationship between Celia and the master. She'd already borne the master two children. She became pregnant again. And essentially, George said to her that you must stop seeing the master or I won't see you. So she had to choose between the two men in many ways. And she chose to go to the white sisters and ask for their help. But they were powerless to help her. Really, they were as dependent on their father as Celia was for her sustenance and shelter.
All right, Robert Newsom came to her one night, and we moved toward a conclusion of this.
That's
tragic
correct.
Story.
She had threatened him if he insisted on sexual intercourse with her, and he came in and insisted, and she picked up a very large stick that was in her cabin, which he'd built especially for her, by the way, and literally beat him to death.
And over the course of, what, 6-8 hours, apparently Celia, a slave, managed to dispose of the body. She was 19 years old. She was sick. She was probably pregnant. How do we figure out what really happened here?
Well, we don't know what really happened except what's in the trial record. She also had two children in that cabin.
My gosh. Under
5 years of age. So what she did was to burn the body in her fireplace. Remember that she was a cook.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day she had the legitimate grandson of Robert Newsom take out the ashes. But I don't know that Celia did not have help in disposing of the body. There's nothing in the record to show that she did, and she, she continued to deny that she did right up until her death, but the facts of the case tend to me to indicate that she may very well have had help.
All right, now, as you tell this story, Melton McLaurin, I believe it's one time we actually hear the voice of Celia herself. She is a haunting presence in this book, but we actually listen to her one time. That's when she's testifying. It's basically a description of her testimony at her trial. Again, a very complex story, but can you be brief and tell me about the trial itself?
Well, she got a very good trial in the sense that slaves could have attorneys in a capital case. And what happened was the attorney who was appointed to defend her, and there were really three, was an extremely well-known trial lawyer named John Jameson in Fulton, Missouri. He was a three-term Democratic congressman, and he didn't have a good reputation for legal research, so the court assigned two younger lawyers, two less experienced trial lawyers, to work for him.
But he was a good trial lawyer.
He was one of the best trial lawyers in the state of Missouri, and I think he was assigned the case so that those who were opposed to slavery, abolitionists, could not use the fact that Celia was not given a good defense against the system of slavery. And it's one of the things that Southerners like to point out, that slaves had certain legal rights and that they were very careful to observe those legal rights.
All right, now here we get into what you call, you and your sources in Celia, a Slave, you call the moral dilemma, the grand problems behind the enormity of slavery, and then behind the specific kinds of examples that you tell about in this book.
Well, everybody in this case faced a moral dilemma, except perhaps Robert Newsom, who'd already made up his mind when he bought Celia why he was buying her. But the girls, the Newsom girls, faced a moral dilemma once Celia came to them and said, "Please help me." Even George faced a moral dilemma. George could have acquiesced in her relationship with Robert Newsom rather than force the issue. After all, Celia couldn't break it off. It was not really within her power to break it off, as we see. The lawyers had a moral dilemma. Should they really put up as strong a defense as they possibly could, which they did? They actually put up a radical defense, a defense that, if it had been accepted, would have vastly altered the fate of slavery in the American South.
And parenthetically, what that amounted to was granting to Celia and people like Celia the status of white women in the antebellum South.
That's correct. It was not illegal to rape a slave woman in the antebellum South, not even for black males to rape a slave woman. They were chattel, they were property, so any rape was considered trespass on the owner's property. So there's a tremendous moral dilemma just when you start discussing the issue of rape, and no white man was ever punished for raping a slave simply because it wasn't a crime. So the defense was going well above the call of duty by saying that a black woman had an absolute right to defend her honor, and it would have seriously undercut the master's control of the slave and the reproductive rights of women. And when you remember that a master who has a child by a woman, a slave woman, also increases his capital.
Sure.
It was an economic bonus for him.
His property, exactly.
Right.
You read this book, Melton McLaurin, and in a way it's like a novel. You move. It's a slim book, 125 pages or so. You move toward the conclusion, and you say to yourself, oh, will she get off? I mean, are they going to let her go? And you know, of course, that doesn't happen.
Well, I certainly hope it's like a novel. I tried very hard to make it that way. That was a part of the writing process. No, it doesn't happen, but she does escape. She is broken out of jail, actually, after her conviction for a variety of legal reasons that I don't have time to get into here.
And then taken back to jail.
And I'm fairly convinced, although I could not prove it, that her lawyers were behind her escape to try to give her every opportunity to appeal her case to the Missouri Supreme Court, which she did. And then after her appeal was denied, they could not bring themselves to take her out of the state or to send her to Canada. They were in the legal system, and my belief is that the lawyers brought her back to jail and she was eventually hanged. I can't prove that, but she was returned to jail after the lawyers had requested an appeal, and after the appeal had been heard.
Do you think you could write this story as a novel? Should it be written that way?
It certainly has all the elements of a novel. It's difficult to do. The descriptions are not difficult to do, but it is difficult to get into the heads of the characters And there's a question of how far you want to push this. I mean, after all, I'm a white Southern male. Do I want to tell this from the point of view of a black female slave in 1855? I doubt it, and yet in many ways it's her story. It would be terribly difficult to tell from other perspectives. As you can see, this is something that I have not neglected to give some thought.
apropos of that, the story of slavery in the American South has been compared to the enormity of the Holocaust. Why do we continue to remember? What is your function as a historian in recounting stories such as that of Celia, a slave?
Well, I think slavery and race relate. You have to always remember that slavery was not just a system of economics, it was a system of race relations. And that makes slavery pertinent to today's racial problem. Race continues to remain the significant unsolved problem in American history. And if you look at the fate of Celia the slave, you will see that the treatment that black women received under slavery persisted in segregation, and indeed up into the present. Perhaps the physical coercion is not there. The actual sexual abuse is not there the way it was clearly in Southern society up until the end of the 1960s with the breakdown of segregation. But much of the so-called feminization of poverty in American society is black feminization of poverty.
Do you think that the South has gotten over slavery? Is it irrelevant even to ask? The past is back there. We go on with our lives. What?
We never leave the past. It's always there. And as I said, race is this fundamental problem in our society. The slavery period can be instructive, even in looking at racial problems that we have today. And I'm fairly firmly convinced of that. I have to be as a historian. That's how I make my living.
Melton McLaurin, I congratulate you on your book, Celia, a Slave. It's being published this month, February of 1993, by Avon in connection with Black History Month, originally published by the University of Georgia Press. You are a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Very quickly, tell me what you're working on now.
Well, now I am working on something on country music, which will be coming out fairly soon. Maybe will be out by the time this program airs, I hope. And I'm also working on a black minister who is a bit of a con man in the 19th century and goes to Great Britain and takes a great deal of money from the Scots.
Well, good luck in your work. Melton McLaurin, thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. And again, congratulations on your book, Celia, a Slave.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the third in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993.
Race on whose part? Because African elites were also persons of African descent, i.e. they were black. Mm-hmm. Now, race in the sense that the Europeans enslaved persons of African descent and slavery in the Americas came to be defined on the basis of race, but to suggest that the institution from its inception was a racial institution is in fact problematic. I think
Herman Bennett, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Bennett teaches courses about the transatlantic slave trade that existed between West Central Africa and the Americas from the early 16th to the middle of the 19th centuries. During that time, according to Herman Bennett, between 12 and 15 million Africans survived the infamous Middle Passage. I asked him to describe how he tells his students about the history of the transatlantic slave trade. In that context, I also asked him to reflect on the question of who bears the responsibility for one of the tragic enormities of modern history.
I think it is important that we continue to apply moral criticism to those who were guilty and perpetrated these particular crimes against humanity. Now, the issue is not simply to focus on Europeans or even to focus on European elites. The issue is also to include African elites who participated in this particular process. That is important, that people recognize that there was a complicity on the part of European elites, that is, slave merchants and traders, as well as African elites who participated and actually wielded power in relation in their relationship with European merchants.
All right, now that's not a popular thing to say necessarily, is it? I mean, there are some schools of history or historians who will look back and say, we got a monolithic set of villains back there. And what you're telling me is that, no, it's far more complicated than that.
Indeed it is. And in fact, until we accept and understand the historical process as it truly transpired, then until that moment, then what we in fact are teaching students and what we are in fact working with, the particular kinds of assumptions, political assumptions as well, are flawed.
Well, now, how do you tease those assumptions out, Hermit, if the record itself is so sparse? I mean, clearly you have lots of records back there, the number of people transported, who owned these companies, the people in West Africa who were responsible for, what should we call this?
And West Central Africa.
West Central Africa. Should we call it a betrayal of their own people?
No. In fact, I sorry to interfere there, but I want to make it very clear. We are not talking about Africans selling their own.
Uh-huh.
We are, in fact, talking about elites, African elites, who defined working peoples throughout their own societies, as well as other ethnic groups, as defining those individuals as the other.
Mm-hmm.
And if we recognize diversity and differences among Africans, recognizing that the notion of Africans or the notion of Africa and Africans is in fact a creation, that is not how people lived and experienced their lives. That's not how they perceived of themselves. Recognizing those differences, that will allow us to see and to understand that in fact these individuals had those differences, and those allowed them to make distinctions about who would be sold and allow them to perpetrate these particular kinds of crimes.
Uh-huh. Let me look at you a little bit wide-eyed here, Herman Bennett. Was it color? Was it race? Was that the defining factor? How do we search for the beginning of a word like racism?
Race on whose part? Because African elites were also persons of African descent, i.e. they were black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, race in the sense that the Europeans enslaved persons of African descent, and slavery in the Americas came to be defined on the basis of race. But to suggest that the institution from its inception was a racial institution is in fact problematic. I think the historical experience, that is the use of indigenous peoples in the Americas, the use of indigenous peoples, both in South and in North America, and subsequently the use of European indentured servants, suggests that European elites were quite willing to experiment with other forms of labor regimentation.
Hmm.
Only with the failure of those institutions did they systematically seek to introduce persons of African descent. So I think that the historical record shows that in fact race is something that grew out of this particular experience and the European expansion.
Let me ask you a bit of a loaded question. Here we are looking back at 1992, the quincentenary of Columbus's arrival or encounter or whatever you want to call it. Was Columbus really a villain? I mean, the bad rap is that here's the guy that introduced racism and slavery into the Americas. Is that too simple a picture? What?
Yes, I think in fact it is too simple of a picture, because Columbus as a person may not have necessarily been a villain, but he did epitomize a particular period. He did epitomize the European elite experience and expansion overseas.
Mm.
Now, we need, I think what has happened, people have personalized their criticisms against Columbus rather than recognizing that he was basically the vanguard of a larger process, that he was simply a symptom, a manifestation of the European colonial experience.
Let's turn our attention to what you do at the University of North Carolina. That is to say, you teach a course called the Transatlantic Slave Trade. How do you bring this enormity, this unbelievable set of circumstances, terribly complex issues, political, cultural, personal, how do you bring that to the minds of kids who were born, what, in the late 60s, in the early 70s? Tell me how you teach this stuff.
Well, to begin with, I start off the first day of class. I begin by literally provoking students and suggesting to them, and in fact informing them, that it is not my position to stand before them to make them feel comfortable. I'm here to provoke them, to challenge them. Uh-huh. And that I, in fact, ask those who may feel uncomfortable with some of the subject matters at hand to perhaps find another course.
How do they react to this, Herman? I mean, do they take this, do they come into it thinking I'm going to learn nothing but facts and figures, or how aware are they of the ideological dimensions?
I think most of them, both black and white, enter this class with particular assumptions. But within the first few weeks, however, they realize that this is not your standard history course. Hmm. I'm not interested, and most historians who teach this are not simply teaching chronology, dates, and facts. The course is thematic, and one deals with a lot of issues that have not only bearing on the historical past, but also on the contemporary present.
Do you have kids who come into your courses, Herman, and sort of like, I mean, no disrespect here when I say sort of like little Alex Haley's. I mean, they are looking for their roots, and they figure that with a black professor teaching a course in slavery, it's going to be a form of historical therapy. That's one of the criticisms that's being leveled against this kind of teaching.
Right. You do, in fact, have these young Alex Haley's, but in this current day and age, I think what you have are many more Malcolm X's going to Mecca and are seeking to basically have their own beliefs reaffirmed.
How do you work a middle ground, or is that the proper term to apply to you as a professor in teaching this?
I'm not sure we're working with a middle ground. First of all, my intentions are to disabuse some of the prevailing stereotypes that do exist on the part of black folks as well as white folks. But that also requires us to move beyond studying the pharaohs. That is, move beyond looking at great empires, move beyond studying kings and queens and the current cultural incarnations of these great men and women, to actually look at the individuals who were at the core of these societies, the people who became the victims of the slave trade.
A history from the bottom up, so to speak.
More or less.
How do you come to this topic when we look at a word like multiculturalism? This must be a big challenge to you. That is, history for the sake of history, history for the sake of contemporary politics.
That is not an issue at UNC, and this hasn't been an issue in many of the classrooms and academic environments that I have been in. And I am quite aware of this particular debate that has permeated in the universities and sort of is quite pervasive in certain circles.
But that happens amongst the professors and the graduate students.
Perhaps more than there. Students are aware of these terms, but are not really that concerned or preoccupied with those issues. Now, in terms of vantage point and perspectives, of course, I'm not interested in teaching the history simply of the European merchants and what Europeans do to Africans. That itself is traditional, the traditional view of the slave trade and the traditional view of the black experience, race relations, and what Europeans are, the kinds of crimes Europeans allegedly and in fact did commit against persons of African descent. But whose history is that? That is the central question. Now, in terms of what multiculturalism, as I see it, has done, is simply sought to center the lives and experiences, the consciousness and the activities of the oppressed, of the colonized, and of the enslaved at the center of their own lives.
And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that.
Of course not.
Depending upon how we create the emphasis. Particular teachers in particular courses.
Of course, and there's nothing wrong with centering the enslaved in their own lives, nor is there anything wrong with centering Europeans, that is European elites or European peasantry in their own lives. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue is the intersection between those histories, between the history of Europe or the histories of Europe, as well as the histories of persons of African descent. Now, there is where the question of contestation and the issue of whose perspective is one teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what is important there is for historians to recognize that we cannot write adequately the histories of all people within these larger world historical texts and within these larger historical works. It's simply not possible. One makes choices that reflect one's own ideological disposition.
Mm-hmm. Herman Bennett, thanks for coming by and contributing to Soundings. You teach the history, the culture, the politics of the African diaspora at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I appreciate your contribution to Soundings for Black History Month 93. Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of four programs for Black History Month 1993. My guests were Melton McLaurin and Herman Bennett, both professors of history at the University of North Carolina. Melton McLaurin is the author of Celia, a Slave. Herman Bennett teaches the history of the transatlantic slave trade. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 647. That's program number 647, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The center welcomes your comments. Next week, part 4 of Soundings for Black History Month 1993. Join me for Readings and Conversation featuring D.L. Crockett Smith, a poet and literary critic who teaches at Williams College. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Black History Month, the third program in a series of four discussions this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Historians Melton McLaurin and Herman Bennett talk about slavery in the Americas. Melton McLaurin discusses his book, Celia, a Slave. Herman Bennett will be here to talk about the history and contemporary impact of the transatlantic slave trade. Slavery and its historical meanings for Black History Month this week on Soundings.